I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
My family told me later that I was actually sitting on my rocking horse, age two, and they were trying to get my attention, but I was like humming and singing. I think I was 10. It was my first time on stage, and I remember fainting. And then I just sang some Schlager, and everybody was applauding, saying, "Well, that was really good." And I seem to remember that incident. It must have meant something. I was only the guest singer, so I could be pretty crazy, you know, and just sort of tag along, which I did. But I mean, I just loved all the people. They were nuts. They were all insane, you know, in a very good way. I was too busy trying to be myself, not being myself, you know, it's just trying so hard. And I had no idea that the song was already so big in the clubs. Like, I had zero idea. And I remember 6 a.m, my performance, you know, and I'm coming out and this wave of shouts, screams and love, you know, coming towards me, like literally, like this wave. And I hadn't even sung a note. The beat started and people went crazy.
Billy Ray Martin, first of all, this has been an enormous pleasure just doing the research.
Wow.
You know, sometimes when you do the research into an artist, you discover parallels and places where your lives have crossed.
Yeah.
And experiences where they've crossed, and also through the music, certain emotions and times come back up, and it's very touching, and you're touched by it. And that was the experience I've had. So I want to kick straight in and talk about the Hamburg that you grew up in, and what was the Hamburg like at that time, and what was the family atmosphere like?
Everybody who was there at the time or grew up in the Hamburg of earlier times will confirm what I'm saying. It had soul. It was just full of soul, because you had the world's biggest harbors there, and it was a time where sailors were coming from all over the world, you know, into Hamburg, bringing their cultures, bringing things from overseas. I mean, there were weird things. I mean, they were bringing animals and things that nowadays luckily wouldn't be allowed, you know, but they would bring whatever they thought they could maybe sell or give to people, you know. I mean, anything at all, you know, really, really weird and fucked up things as well. But it was like interesting and strange and bizarre. And then of course you had, because of that, you had the whole culture of the red light district, which, you know, was a busy time, let's say, you know, and there was a lot of money to be made. So it was also very glamorous, you know, and the business owners there, I mean, they were up to about the mid end 70s, mid 80s. I mean, they were getting seriously rich, you know, and the pimps were legends. I mean, this was like an episode of, you know, like characters out of Pulp Fiction. Hamburg style. I mean, they were all famous. When one of them died or something, there would be like a Hollywood style burial, and every gangster in town would be there. I mean, this was like the real shit, you know? And so it was just so alive. And my grandmother, who loved Hamburg and who loved the whole scene, you know, in the area we grew up in, she made it even more exciting because she made it seem that way, you know, to me as a child. You know, she would take me on walks, and I mean the Sunday walk could be literally down the Reeperbahn, you know, where some people would say, oh, you don't go there, but there was nothing seedy about it. For us, it was just looking at the glamorous shop windows and the paintings and the drawings of ladies, and you know. So this, I mean, this was a famous, famous time. This was the heyday of Hamburg Harbor, Red Light District, you know. So it was so full of soul. And I wouldn't call it a shop. There was this place called Harry's Harbor Bazaar. And it was super, super famous. And it was a four-story, a small, long building, a four-story building that was selling things that sailors had brought. So you could find, there was a floor called the Dead Zoo. It was all taxidermy animals, you know. So that was like weird. And the ground floor was all shells and, you know, things from the sea. And also, what do you want to call, you know, parts from ships, and then I mean, there were even shrunken heads there from Africa and from, you know. And so as a kid, it was normal for me. Oh, a shrunken head, you know, no problem. And some people have said to me, and now I know why you're so fucked up, because like, you know, you saw shrunken heads, you know. And I mean, people would buy that and hang it up in their living room, you know. So
oh, that sounds really weird.
But I mean, also don't forget, you know, all the central areas in Hamburg were working class. They weren't gentrified like they are now, you know. They were interesting. They were working class areas. Everybody knew each other. You know what I mean? So there was all that. It was a real community.
I mean, you are from a working class family, and, you know, I've read about that. And also, I just wondered what then did a working class family give you that has been useful in your life, in your attitude, in the way that you've worked through your life? What do you think they left you with in that way?
Probably everything, because I don't even know if it was a process, but now I'm just so proud of where I came from, you know, because of our, you know, the whole family background, being incredibly unpretentious. That's a gift, right? So, I mean, it also leaves you with a lack of self-esteem, because there's also that, well, all that stuff out there is not for us. So as a singer, because I already sang as a child, so there was this sense of, well, but I want to be on that television where those other people are, you know, and I would voice that to my family, you know, my grandmother and my grandfather. And there was a sense of, no, that's for other people, you know? So there is that. But then it took me all my life to go, well, you know, if I hadn't had to work through that, I mean, I'm only now finding my true self-esteem now. I mean, you know, so I think it's a gift, but you don't necessarily know it's a gift until later in life, you know?
That's a really interesting point, because I come from a working class family, and I have the same vision. No one in our family had been to university. No one had ever worked in the wider term, the arts or a creative industry. And it did seem like an unreal thing to want.
Yes.
And this lack of self-esteem can also be a driving force in your life.
It
do you feel it was that?
It was that. I mean, but when you're young, you kind of work through all kinds of pain, but you don't necessarily, in my case, I was never really in touch with myself, you know? I just worked through the pain blindly, because that's when you do when you're young. You know, there's a lyric by the Pet Shop Boys, which is one of my favorite lines. We could do anything, we're fearless when we're young, you know? So we work through the pain, but we don't realize that there's all that pain there, you know? We just work through it, you know? I had to, you know, to say it was hard, it would be an understatement, you know.
What music were you around? What music did your parents play, and what music was sort of played at home?
I was brought up by my grandparents, and they had an Elvis collection, and they had a Beatles collection, and they had German Schlager music, of course, you know. So I would listen to anything on the radio, anything that was on the radio I knew, and that would be my education. But then also I think there were 10-inch records at the time, right? And 7-inch records. So they had all that. So I grew up with a bit of history there, you know, and the Beatles were still big when I grew up as well, you know. I mean, it wasn't like they were gone at all. And especially because they'd become famous in Hamburg, they were so very present, you know.
Didn't your mother work at the Star Club?
She worked at the Star Club and at the Top 10 after that. I can never remember the sequence of it, but I think the Top 10 was after the Star Club. Yeah, she knew the Beatles. She knew them briefly when nobody, you know, knew who they were, just a band playing. And that's why my mother ended up staying a waitress in the Red Light District, because she wanted to be around music. That's what it was initially about for her, and so she just stayed on, and then later kept, you know, her entire life, and she worked in the Red Light District. So did my aunts and my uncles and my stepfathers, and my, you know, so it's like a real so and to this day, I mean, those are the types of characters I write about, you know, in case anyone's wondering.
Well, it's also a very sort of streetwise type environment, and I can imagine that in that environment, you grow up very quickly. I know that you started,
Yeah, I was gonna say, actually, my grandmother was hell-bent on protecting me from all of the seediness that she didn't want, because she said, you know, my daughter ended up there, and this, you know, your mother, and you are not, if it's the last thing I do, you know, you will not ever enter one of those places and go. So she really kept me secluded. I mean, she really did keep me out of that whole environment. You know, except the walks around the area. And I mean, we lived there, so it was nice. But she really, I mean, until the time I left home quite early, but I was a teenager, and she really kept me on a leash, you know. She didn't want me to get into any trouble at all.
You mentioned Elvis Presley and also Schlager music. I don't know who that might have been, Marianne Rosenberg or...
Yes, also, yeah.
I mean, these are real voices. These are incredible voices. So was it that appealed to you about the people that they were listening to at that time? And when did your musical tastes start to diverge from theirs?
I think in Schlager music you had a huge amount of bad voices too, you know, people, but it was about the songs, it was about a song structure, you know, it was about verse, bridge, chorus, you know, like a real proper songwriting thing. And I think that's what I learned from the radio and from the records, you know. And then of course if there was a great voice, even better, you know. But I think I also learned just radio songs, songwriting, you know. And then I think it was when, you know, I heard, when I had grown up just a little bit, you know, Elton John, people like that. That's when I really got into voices, because his earlier music, you know, his voice is just incredible. And that's when I really became aware, you know, of what people put across in their voice.
When did you realize that you had a voice?
I sang it sounds really weird, but from when I was born. Of course, I didn't know I had a voice, you know, but my family told me later that I was actually sitting on my rocking horse, age 2, and they were trying to get my attention, but I was like humming and singing, and they couldn't get my attention. So I was always singing. By the age of 5, I was making demo tapes. And I mean, they were children's songs, you know, they were nothing. But then sort of by age 8, 9, I was singing Schlager, and I was singing whatever was in the charts. And, you know, and I can't remember. Yeah, in the Hit Parade, we had this program, which you might know, the Hit Parade on television. So I would, you know, every song I would sing, I would record. I would say to my grandmother, here, send that off to my favorite singer, you know, find out her address, you know. So I was really becoming not so much aware, because, you know, I don't think my voice would have had a lot of character then, you know, but I just knew I wanted to sing, and that's all I was ever interested in, you know. And then, you know, one day there was a family celebration and all the family were there, and there were like 50, 60 people there. And then someone said, and I said, oh, I'll go up on stage. And I think I was 10. It's my first time on stage, and I remember fainting, like almost, you know, like, because I realized something was happening here that I had no, and then I just sang some Schlager, and everybody was applauding, saying, well, that was really good. And I seem to remember that incident. It must have meant something, you know. So I mean, maybe that was the point where I thought, ooh, these people are actually reacting to something here, you know. So
I mean, one of the interesting things is you mentioned that your grandmother, obviously the matriarch of the whole family, because she sounds like she was the strong, dominant figure. And also that the idea that you could be in television, i.e. follow your creative path, was alien to your family. Mm-hmm. So how did they react when you said, and I know this comes a bit later, but when you said, okay, I'm off to Berlin?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember, because I left home quite early and moved in with my mother, which was weird. And then I sort of went between London and Berlin. I started going to London, kind of running away, you know, on the ferry from Hamburg, you know. So I'm trying to remember. I think I might have gone to London first, even for a short time, you know. And then I went back to finish school, and then, you know, went back again to London, and then went to Berlin. My grandmother was very sad. She didn't like it, you know. But there was, I mean, nothing could stop me, you know. And also leaving your friends behind and realizing there's a big change happening.
So what sort of Berlin did you enter into? Because this is Berlin pre-war. It's an island, in a sense, in East Germany, where you go through these corridors to get there. It's an island full of people who were escaping, having to go to the army, young people mainly. Yeah. And it was, you know, it was a vibrant, incredible city. Yeah. What did you see it as when you got there?
Yeah, it was really nice, because it was a time where it really didn't lag behind London in terms of being really, really vibrant and interesting, which now, I mean, you know, or I think it was probably maybe even the one time where it was that it was insane. It was an insane place. I don't know if you've seen Mark Rieder's movie about, you know, Berlin, you know, I mean, that was his experience. Mine was partly a little bit different, but there was that, and it was just nuts, and everybody could do what they wanted. And because it wasn't about money, Berlin wasn't about money. So in all the bars and clubs and venues and everywhere, you had just people from all walks of life. You had all the artists, and you didn't have to have money or be famous, but they all came together. And that's the one main difference, that you could stand next to David Bowie or one of the famous German painters or whatever artist, and you're a nobody, but you know them and you hang out with them. You know, so that was what made Berlin so incredible. Nobody gave a shit about money. Nobody
I talked to Mark Reeder the other week, and I know him as well, but it was just a fascinating talk, because he mentioned all that you're saying, and also that we forget that West Berlin was so small in comparison to what Berlin is today. and this idea of bumping into people, and also that you didn't need much money to live.
Yeah.
And everyone was looking for something to do, in a sense, creatively.
Yeah.
So you could quickly meet and work with other people. So how did that show itself? What happened to you?
I mean, you would literally, the most famous club was the Jungle. You would literally meet people there and they would say, hey, who are you? You know, you look interesting. Shall we move in together, or shall we, do a project? I paint, and I do this and I do that. I mean, that's how it would work, really, And you made a lot of friends, and people found you, if you were a hit on the dance floor, people would find you incredibly interesting, and you'd become a bit of a local, And I mean, I started singing in bands, and we became quite really well known overnight, and then there were other bands, and they were the same, and we would compete, because it was such a small city in a way. There was so much competition, but it was really healthy, and you could go, you had all the bands performing locally. That's what made it really exciting too, all the new wave groups and all that, So
how did Berlin affect your sort of musical knowledge and your musical experience, and also then how you developed your voice?
Yeah, I mean, Berlin just gave you permission, I think, to explore, because, you could get rehearsal rooms cheaply, so I rented one, and then you'd go in with people and I did soul music, 60s garage music, psychedelic, I tried, because there was a big 60s revival scene, and then in the bedroom we also did some Depeche Mode Eurythmics type of stuff, very badly, and some really batshit crazy electronic, I mean, literally just all happening at the same time, and I was kind of figuring out, I don't know how my voice would fit into all that, one day I went to a record shop in off the Kurfürstendamm in Berlin, and I was going through 60s garage compilations to buy, and the guy, young guy who worked behind the counter, his name is Zaid, came up to me and said, have you ever heard Martha Reeves or the Supremes, have you ever heard soul music? And I don't know why he did that, there's no reason why, and I said, well, maybe not really, and he said, I'm gonna order you a couple of compilations and come back next week and pick them up. So he ordered Martha Reeves compilation and the Vandellas and Supremes, and that changed everything. It changed, so I was messing around with all these different styles,
but tell me, you say what it changed, when you listen to that music and you listen to their voices, what did you understand from that, that you could take from that?
That there was a different world out there where emotions come into play, and emotions are the operating, the operative system there. It's all about feelings and emotions that I had not taken into account. They were singing about everyday things too, But they were singing in, about them in a way that just went straight to the core of you, you know? And that was like, I mean, Martha Reeves, her earlier stuff, there's a really simple song, Love, Love, Love Makes You Do Foolish Things, you know? But when she sings them, she puts it across, something whole, something bigger opened up, you know? And I mean, the production, the sounds, all of it, you know, it just went straight to your heart. And I went, oh God, how do I, so now I have that. And I want to, that's me, this is it, you know. And so I started practicing and rehearsing and then combining that with, you know, I would then sing gospel badly at that time over our bedroom electronic shit, you know, and also in the 60s revival, you know, and then I formed a soul band. So it was all, you know, and I just couldn't put, I couldn't, so music production and then my singing voice had to be somehow brought together. And I think to this day, I'm still trying and exploring. And there are songs that I sing where my voice just doesn't sound right. But because I've written the song, I like it, I'm going to sing it somehow, you know. So some songs work better than others, I think, you know. And some songs might be more successful in terms of the production and the way my voice sounds, you know. So I mean, there's no recipe which I have, you know. That you know that you know when Aretha Franklin sang a song, she made it all her own, you know. And Aretha always sounds like Aretha, but I don't have that gift. I tend to sound different all the time, you know. And there are songs sometimes that I sing where that is me, what comes out is sounds like the ultimate me. So there are songs like that, but then there are other songs where that doesn't happen and I have to see how I make it work, you know.
I mean, those bands in Berlin were the Subtones and Billy and the Deep, I think, that you were talking about. Where, you know, when you sing someone else's song, and I know this is early on in your career, where was the moment? And you sort of mentioned this a little bit, saying that you don't always know if you transfer the emotion of the song, but you have to somehow find the emotion within you to be able, it might be another event that's happened in your life to the event that the writer or the singer first transported it. And you have to find that emotion and that event to be able to transport it. When did you start understanding that this was the power of transporting a song?
I'm trying to remember, but I think when I sang with the Subtones, I was only a guest singer there, you know, and with Billy and the Deep, I was really shouting, just shouting it out, and I still wasn't, you know what I mean, really exploring. I was just like, whatever came out happened, and that was that, and then I moved on, you know. So it was just really funny. So, but the process that I'm now, like exactly how you describe, you know, that I'm now very aware of, that might have happened around the time when I moved to London and we formed Electribe 101, because I remember hearing, I mean, there were sort of events that sort of changed the way I was looking at singing. And one was we covered Inside Out by Odyssey, you know. And that was a song that back in Berlin as a kid, you know, I'd heard that on the radio. And it made me stop in my tracks because he was like a really soulful number, but the singers weren't shouting and they were, you know, there was this really low sung, very mellow delivery of, I didn't know who the singer was, you know. But that song just stuck in my head, you know. And then the other time that happened was again in Berlin. I was walking into yet another record shop, and I'm Gonna Tear Your Playhouse Down by Ann Peebles was playing. And again, I just stood there And they had the record cover up by the till, so I could see who it was. And I said, yeah, give me that, you know? And that, again, that changed everything, because Anne Peebles always sort of, there's just this part of her which understates everything, you know, where she's not going for the high notes necessarily, and she's not going. And that's when I realized there is something here to be explored, you know? So where do I really fit in, and why do these songs really appeal to me?
I mean, I think there is a greater power in the understatement, which definitely comes across in a lot of your work. Yeah. And that is quite beautiful, because it makes the song stronger in some way. Yeah. How do you view this sort of understatement?
Well, sometimes I think, oh God, here I go again, singing a song in a lower octave. And I'm sure people out there want to hear me belt out a song, you know. So sometimes I think like, oh, here we go again, totally under challenging as well for my voice, but I want to put the emotion across. So I make that choice that that's what matters, you know, the melody that I wrote and the emotion that I felt when I wrote the song, you know. And so I go for it and I'm like, oh God, here we go again, you know. So I'm really unsure of myself half the time, you know. And sometimes I notice that my voice really works, like I said, you know, with a song, even if it's understated. And other times I just think it's understated, you know. So it really varies.
Now, you know, you're in Berlin, you're in these couple of bands, and you were getting your first experience. And then you decide to go to London. What was that decision? Were you unhappy in Berlin, or was it really, I want to experience something else now, or I want to take my chance?
Berlin started being very complacent. People started just hanging around, and the heyday was over. Gentrification slowly came in, you know, and I just said to my band members, I'm gonna go, you know, and why don't you join me, you know, we see if we can, you know. So I'd made some effort to get us signed there and stuff, you know, so I'd be sending tapes to rough trade and all that, you know. So it was that, and also, you know, because I'd been traveling to London a couple of times just to hang around and see, and I knew it was my home. I knew it was my second home, or my first, maybe even. I just knew.
Why?
Because people were behaving, I mean, Germans are stuck up, man. And Hamburg is a very, people are very sort of timid and quite stuck up. And I just knew as a teenager and as a child, there has to be something else out there. And then you go to London and you go to the Marquee to see a band, you know, and everybody's celebrating and everybody's talking, strangers talking to you. I'd never experienced that. I remember I started crying, actually. Because I knew that existed out there, that people were being nice to you, you know, and people were into having a laugh and being less stuck up, and, you know, and people just walking up to you because, you know, they might find you interesting and saying, do you want a drink? You know, that does not happen in Germany, at least not to me. So I knew I was going to go. But it was just about finishing school and doing some studies and, you know, and then going to London to be in a band or to form a band because by that time, you know, you did have electronic music out there. And I thought, wow, you know, I want to be part of that. And then when I went, house music happened and bingo, you know, that's what I wanted to put my voice on at the time.
And you went to these first clubs that were really sort of opening up, weren't they? There was, I think it was the Paul Oakenfold Night at Heaven that actually started in the club in Hungerford Lane. Do you remember the club behind Heaven, the little one? There was actually, Heaven was two clubs. It was the massive.
I do. Club. The little one I went to later for some techno and stuff. I don't, that little place. It was great.
Yeah, it started there, and then it grew into the bigger club. I mean, almost immediately, because it was one of those things. So you'd been there, hadn't you? You'd actually experienced that. What was it like? Because I went to Shoom with Kim Mazel when that opened.
Yes, I went there,
and that was just genius. You know,
I met Mark Moore there.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And said to him, I want to sing in your group. And he said, fine. That was that.
So were you aware of who was doing what? Were you actually very aware?
Oh, God, yeah.
Who, you know, I mean, so when you went out, you could sort of say, ah, look, there's so-and-so, and make a beeline in a way.
No, not at all, because that didn't happen in the beginning. In the beginning, I heard there's this new music, this new kind of music, which nobody knows yet, but there's a few people that go to heaven on a, I don't know if it was a Wednesday or whatever it was, you know, Thursday, I have no idea. And that, and there are some strange dances that people do, and you know, and it's something to check out. So I just went, and there were literally 20 people on the dance floor in the big room at heaven, and they were doing sort of robotic dances, and they played acid house, and there were some people standing around the dance floor with their arms folded in front of them, and they were very skeptical, you know. There were some hip-hop guys and all kinds of people standing there going, nah, you know, and what the fuck is this, you know. And I loved it immediately, went back next week. So now you didn't have 20 people on the dance floor, but you had all the hip-hop guys and all the other guys also on the dance. So this grew like wildfire. 3 weeks later, you had 400-500 people. It really was that amazing, you know. And then there was no more, you know, the hip hop guys don't like it and the rare groove guys don't like it. They were all there, you know. So
I mean, the Shroom, when I was at Shroom, there was this massive energy to the club. I mean, it was absolutely incredible. There was, you know, and I really love that. But tell me about this meeting with Mark Moore, because you must have gone up to him and he wouldn't have known who you are. So
no,
how did he react?
No, because I hadn't sung on anything yet in England. But I'd read an interview in the NME of where Mark was saying that anyone who's crazy enough can sing in S Express. And of course, I loved theme from S Express, you know. There was a mystery to the video too. I thought, wow, there are all these people, you know, in the video, and they're great. And so I saw Mark and then plucked up all my courage and went up to him and I said, hi, I'm a singer. And he said, oh, really? And I said, you know, and I saw in the NME that, you know, I could sing in your group. And he said, give me your phone number. And, you know, if something occurs, I'll give you a call. And he did. Took a little while. And he called and said, could you come to the studio tomorrow to sing a couple of things?
Can you remember his reaction to the first time you sang?
Yeah, I think they were very happy. Yeah.
So you then made a couple of tracks with him on that album, didn't you? I don't know how much you worked on the album, but Pimps, Pushers and Prostitutes, of course, which is something, and No Breaks on My Roller Skates, I think, was something to do with him, wasn't it? Or was that different?
Actually, you mean the song that I did later, No Breaks,
oh, that's,
right?
Sorry, then I've got muddled up. So let's go to...
No, there was a third song on the S Express album, and I can never remember what it was or what I did. Shame on me. So no breaks in my roller skates. I did much later. I did like, I don't know when it was, 15 years ago.
Oh, okay. But the songs with Mark Moore and that experience with Mark Moore, what do you feel that that gave you? Because suddenly it feels like when I read about that period, or I've heard interviews with you about that period, it sounds like you suddenly found a little community to be in.
Yeah, because we were, Hey Music Lover was a big hit, and we were booked to play a lot of big festivals and things, you know, and I was only the guest singer, so I could be pretty crazy, you know, and just sort of tag along, which I did. But I mean, I just loved all the people. They were nuts. They were all insane, you know, in a very good way. And Mark was sort of, you know, the mastermind behind it all. He just watched all the madness and found it funny, you know. It's a bit sort of that Andy Warhol thing, you know, you watch the madness and you smile and you to yourself, you know. And we were booked a lot in Germany, playing crazy festivals, and Italy. And so I just had fun, you know. I don't know if I necessarily fitted in with this group, but it was a massive experience, you know, really amazing. And I remember we did this thing in Italy, which I would love to get there's no video of it that we can get hold of. We played in this for a television station in Napoli, in Naples, and I couldn't be bothered to mime to my part. So first of all, I was wearing like a slightly see-through top, and everyone in the group thought it was hilarious because it wasn't really done, but to me it was like normal, you know, just be a bit punk rock, and they were like giggling, and you know, so there was that. And then when my part came up, I Want to Take You Higher, I just stood there, you know, looking bored. Mark thought it was hilarious. We were shown the footage, you know, and Mark saw me not miming, and then anybody else would have kicked me out of the group, you know. And he just thought it was hilarious. So it was really, you could just be yourself in Essex Press.
Were you also writing songs at that stage and actually sort of developing your own creativity in the background, as it were?
I'd already written a lot of songs in Berlin with the Soul, with Billy and the Deep, and also another group. But in London, yeah, on Pimps, Pushers and Prostitutes, I wrote the Who's Gonna Pick Me Up, which later became that song and that song and that song. I would always bring along some bits that I'd written. And at that time I had already written Talking With Myself too, which later became the Electribe song.
So were these songs, okay, I know you wrote some in Berlin on the way, but also in London, were these songs that started to get really influenced by your own experiences, your own relationships, your own feelings and whatever?
Yeah, but that had always been the case, you know, always. So I guess I just developed a little bit, you know, as a writer, probably in earnest, you know. Yeah,
I mean, what I love about your story is that there are immense moments of highs. Mm-hmm. And there are, you know, the rejection and immense moments of lows.
Yeah.
There are the comebacks, there are the changes. It's sort of, it's a film in itself, but a very long film of different dynamics. And one of them is, you know, it includes the cliche of the advert. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's sort of the cliche in the music business, isn't it? Someone puts an advert in a newspaper, you know, Elton John looking for a writer, and along comes Bernie Taupin. And
yes,
it's similarly,
yes.
But what I love about your advert was the terminology, what you wrote. Can you remember what you wrote?
Yeah, Soul Rebel Seeks Musicians, Genius Only.
Now, if I had seen that advert, and I was a musician, and I have no talent in this department, but I was a musician, and I saw that Genius Only, that would scare the shit out of me.
Yeah, I don't know. I just wanted to make sure I don't get, because you know there are always a lot of so-called songwriters around, but they just want to have a hit record and write for commercial commercials and stuff, you know, and I just didn't want them to even come along. You know? Do you know someone who replied to that ad? And he won't remember this. Glenn Matlock.
No.
From the Pistols.
Oh, wow.
Who at the time was obviously no longer in the Pistols, you know. And he left a message, he left a message on my answering machine. He would not remember me probably or that incident, but my answering machine had the Pistols song EMI on my answering machine. So when you called me, it would play a Pistols song. And then there was a message when I got home saying, I wrote that. So I called him back and we talked, but I don't know why, but we never met. You know, I think he said, you know, I'm forming a band or I'm doing something. And somehow, for some reason, I hooked up with the other guys instead. So
but when that is an amazing story. Amazing, you know, the idea of you and Glenn Matlock is also phenomenal. Did you meet the geniuses and did you think they were geniuses when you met them?
No, because they looked like an East German rock band when I met them. They would hate me for saying that. No, because they were just starting to dabble in the same kind of music, the acid house and the house and the dance music that I was interested in. But when they came, they didn't really make that clear, you know? They just sort of said, well, we're in this band and, you know, we don't like our singer and we're looking for someone. And I said, nah. So they kept calling me, Brian kept calling me, saying, yeah, but we have a studio in Birmingham, you know, and you can bring your songs. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm coming, you know? So, and I basically walked in with three demos. And when Brian heard the Talking With Myself demo, which was of course completely different from what it later became, he said, you know, Billy, I think that's the song that we should do. And I said, okay. So that's what we did. And so I think I did find my geniuses. I really feel, especially, you know, now listening to the new in inverted commas album that's out, I just can't overstate how brilliant they are. And at the time, you know, sometimes when you're making music in a group, you don't even realize it.
What was the dynamic between you at first? Were you very much in control in the studio, or were they, or was it really a sort of thing of the contribution came from every angle? Because sometimes there is a dynamic, and I can tell that you are quite a strong character, even from this interview, you know. Well, and that's probably what comes from your grandmother.
Oh yeah. So I mean, I would bring the records, you know. I would bring Julian Jonas, Jealousies and Lies, and I said, that's the production, you know. And I would bring Persuasion, and, you know, I would bring Soul Records, which they already knew, they already loved all that music. You know, but then of course, so they also were already playing around with stuff, and so it came together, and I think their influence can't be overstated, you know. And even though I was always moaning about this and that element of the production, or, you know, it was very much everybody brought their influence in, and that I can't overstate how much you can hear that on this new album, because when I listened to Joe was the drum guy, but also doing the hooks, you know, all those beautiful Kraftwerk-y hooks and stuff. I mean, wow, you know, he just came up with that, and that was suddenly just there for me to sing over, you know. And then, and so I could go on and on about all of them bringing something that they already had, but that they had not been able to explore fully, you know. So I think we gave to each other, you know. In terms of a personal dynamic, it's difficult, you know. If you ever try to join four Brummies, you know, I mean, they're their own breed, and they were already a gang. So I was very much the outsider, you know. And we became closer as time went on, you know, but there were also frictions and pressures, and, you know, it all went to pot at some point, you know. So, but I certainly felt,
you know, you did have success initially, and yeah. But you stayed in London, didn't you? And they were in Birmingham. Yeah. During this period, and you went up there and recorded, and then
right.
The album came out, but you had success. How did that success feel, And what was your vision of that success? Where did you think that was now going to go?
It's so funny because I never thought of it. It was almost like I'd come from Berlin. I went through some real poverty in London, and suddenly we weren't poor anymore. It was actually the same for the guys, you know. We were all piss poor before that, and suddenly we had a bit of money. But in terms of the success, I never thought about it. I just went, yeah, well, that's what I was trying to say all along in my songs, you know. And suddenly everyone's writing, here's this great new soul singer. And they were interviewing me with questions that reflected that. And I was like, yeah, of course, yeah, you know. So, but I wasn't big-headed about it. I was just, yeah, well, that's my story. And finally, I can tell it, you know. So I wasn't even stopping for a minute to think about it. I never thought about it. I just, you know, because I was, the concepts for videos and clothing and styling, that all came from me as well. So I was busy. I was just busy, you know, and every now and then I would do these interviews going, yeah, you know, and moving on to whatever happened next.
I mean, you talked earlier about sort of self-esteem and a lack of self-esteem. This really suggests that there wasn't a lack of self-esteem by that stage.
No, there was. I just didn't stop. Yeah, I just didn't stop to reflect on anything.
So what was the lack of self-esteem at that stage when you're successful, when you are getting, you know, I mean, you got critically great attention when music journalists start liking your stuff. Mm-hmm. I think for artists, it means a huge amount. It means a huge amount for the audience, but the critical side of the audience loving it as well is another sort of positive. So I just wonder what that self-esteem was like and that feeling.
I was too busy trying to be myself, not being myself, you know, it's just trying so hard. I was too busy. I never noticed, you know, I'm on top of the pops shimmying away. When I look at it now, those performances, they were strange, but they were also quite good, you know, because I was taking dance lessons from one of the best dancers ever, Suki Miles, you know, and she taught me all that stuff, you know, and I just wanted to be the best I could be, you know, final, you know what I mean? And I would always like try and add something else to it. I was never satisfied, you know. We took Suki on tour with us. I wanted her on stage next to me, you know. I wanted to do like a dancing together. I just didn't want to be just by myself there, you know. So I was always just trying to add the next thing, to try and be myself and figure out what else can I do to make this work, you know.
What did the Depeche Mode gig do to your, you know, to supporting Depeche Mode? What did that do to your confidence? Because it does sound horrendous.
Yeah, it was. I mean, like somebody said, I should do a 8-part Netflix series about my whole experience in the music industry, because I haven't really, it's never been written down, or, you know, I'm not about to write a book anytime soon. It was, in those days, Depeche Mode's fans were sort of really hardcore, you know, and they would just not want any support group on stage. It didn't matter who you were. So we were bottled off stage every night, you know, and we had to stand there and take it and face it. Sometimes I didn't want to go out. Sometimes I didn't go out because I was that distraught by it all, you know. I didn't understand it at first. I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to do this for 2 months, you know. And the band Depeche Mode, they were feeling sorry for us, you know. And they said, yeah, they do that to all of the groups, you know. And I think the band started breaking up because of it, because we were just quite unhappy, you know.
Well, the pressures must have been immense. You know, if you go out on stage and you're having, you know, missiles of certain sorts thrown at you. One thing, you know, that you had tomatoes thrown at you. And I just thought, like, what? How do people get hold of tomatoes at a gig?
They bring them in plastic bags in Paris. It's in Paris. It's a fucking sport. And apparently the Beatles didn't go back for 14 years after they played in Paris once earlier in their career. They bring plastic bags. I don't know if they still do it now, those bastards. They bring plastic bags with coins, shoes, tomatoes, vegetables, and just to fucking throw them at you. And there was this, there were all these things where now I can laugh about it and the group could laugh about it. At the time, nobody laughed about it. There was this one thing where we were playing a song and the lights would always go down at in that particular moment in the song, because there were, I think there were three nights in Paris in this big stadium. And so the lights went down, you know, because we were already being, you know, bottled off stage and stuff. And we were standing there and the lights went down and I felt this drizzle. And I thought, that's interesting, like a rain effect coming from, you know, somewhere. And when the lights went back up, I sort of turned around and Les on his bass keyboard, at his bass keyboard, he was standing there covered in tomatoes. And one of the tomatoes had switched the keyboard off. And we were all looking at him like, oh my God. And it was so funny, but it wasn't at that time, you know what I mean? And then I remember going after the show and I turned around to the band and I said, after the song, we're off stage, we're going. We're not, you know, so we went off stage. Then we went down to the canteen to eat with Depeche Mode there. And the caterers, they said, would you like some tomatoes with your with your meal? You know, so they were taking a mick out of us, you know. But at that time, we were not smiling, I can tell you, you know.
No, I can imagine that. I mean, it's funny to hear a story like that. You know, it's definitely funny to hear a story like that. But to be on the receiving end, night after night, and to have that humiliation, it's something that grows within you and is very destructive. How do you think that played into, you had the manager, Tom Watkins, who was also a quite destructive character.
Right.
And he was trying to split up the band, as I understand. Mm-hmm. Which is sort of a classic thing that you know, some managers do, and I never know where it really comes from. Did he have his reason? Did he have a particular reason? Financial? He wanted someone solo. Well, he wanted this.
I mean, to be honest, he did it to Bros, and he tried to sack Chris Lowe from the Pet Shop Boys. I mean, you know, but a lot of people in his office, his staff, and also his co-manager, they would take me aside. And they would say he does that to all the women. So go figure, you know.
Yeah. That's terrible. And of course, you know, you have this horrendous humiliation with Depeche Mode. You know, you have the problems with Tom Watkins. Mm. Then you don't have a hit with Inside Out. Mm-hmm. And then you have the humiliation with the second album in terms of the record company. Can you tell me about that moment that it was rejected and what that did to you?
I think we'd already been arguing as a band between us, you know, so there weren't a lot of good feelings left for many reasons after the tour, you know. And we were trying to, I remember we were musically unsure of ourselves, which listening back to the album now, it's crazy. We had, you know, we could have, I think we knew there was some stuff, but I don't think we were sure that we had an album, you know. And we were also sort of put in the studio with another producer to help us out, and you know, all that big record company stuff that happens to groups, you know, and then I don't think we were very sure. And we did some other demos as well, which I'm not gonna put out there, because we were just sort of, because I would come in with drum and bass, you know, my latest discovery, you know, let's do some of that. And I remember the guys saying, yeah, okay, but I don't know if our demos are good enough. And, you know, so, and I think, so the final straw is then, you know, we deliver this album. And I mean, we did put across that there are a couple of mixes that might need looking at again, you know, but here it is, you know, here's. And then we were told it's a pile of shit.
What, literally those words?
Well, our A&R guy, someone put it to us. At the time, we'd gotten rid of Tom Watkins, so I can't remember who actually told us that we were being dropped from the label. And we were told that the managing director had said, "What's with this soul shit?" So we then were without a deal. We tried to get signed and didn't get signed right away. And I think it was different times then, because you didn't have the digital world out there where bands can just go, fuck it, we can release this, you know. I mean, you could form a label, but you'd have to be a very strong unit to do that. And, you know, because it was all about physical, you know, vinyl pressings, you know, and cassettes and, you know, whatever people did at the time. So I don't think that culture was out there yet of being totally self-sufficient. So I think we just broke up instead, you know.
Yeah. I mean, rejection is a very hard thing to deal with. It's hard when you're not successful, but when you've been successful and then you get rejected, it's a bit of a double whammy. So how did that make you feel inside, and what was your reaction to it? Did you sort of hide away at first?
I went to Warner Chappell and they had a demo studio, a very good one actually. And I said, look, I don't really know what to do, but you know, we broke up. I told them the band had broken up, and I said, well, let me do some demos, you know, in the studio. So I did some demos, and but I remember having absolutely no money, and so that was the hardest, actually, to be really like without really worrying about having a roof over your head, you know. So I just did demos for quite a long time.
I mean, I know that financial problem, yeah. Because if you've, you know, I mean, after I my career sort of died at one point, I had, you know, before that I had a lot of money and I lost everything. I lost my house because, you know, you live on a certain amount of debt sometimes as well. And
exactly.
when the carpet's pulled away, then there's really something, it's about existence and it's about that moment of existence. And that is crushing for your creativity for a while. Yeah. Was it for you?
No, because I just did demos and songwriting. And so the creativity is just, I don't think I had any support network. I think that was the problem about what to do with it. You know, I had no manager, no band, no co-musicians. You know, I would just sort of work with the odd person here and there. And so I think that was the problem more than anything, that I had no infrastructure in which to operate and have my voice maybe put out there again. That didn't happen for 2 years. And it only happened when, because I was so fed up about, because I had at that, so to about, I would say a year and a bit after the band got dropped, I'd written Your Loving Arms, you know.
Did you write that with David Harrow?
Yeah, he did a bit of a techno-y little backing track, which I still have the cassette of, actually. And I wrote a song on top, you know. So I had Your Loving Arms, and I had demoed it already, pretty much sounding the way it ended up later sounding. And so I would go around some record companies, you know. I think the publishers probably helped me get a meeting here and there. And it was rejected absolutely everywhere. So I went to New York. Was rejected there, you know. And later when it was a big hit in America, they were all like, oh shit, well, you know, we wish we would have signed it. And I'm like, yeah, well, you didn't, you know. So anyway, nobody signed that. And then I remember, and then I had a really terrible manager for a short while, you know, who did absolutely nothing. And one day I was so fed up. And I said to him, you know, don't you think I should do a short showcase gig with my demos? And he just went, well, I don't get involved in that sort of thing. And that was the final straw. And I just called the Jazz Cafe and said, let me do a gig there. You know, and they said, sure. And I was signed literally the next day.
Now, Your Loving Arms was, in essence, for me, I see that as a gay man, as a gay anthem. you know, and it was something, and I have wonderful memories of that song, and there's something so warm and wonderful, and it's almost like an insular experience of love. Mm-hmm. It's a very beautiful song. And you performed that in Miami at a gay club in Miami. Can you tell me about that?
All the time. I performed it. I think there wasn't a gay club in Miami where I didn't perform. It was, oh my God, it was great. I mean, my first performance was in New York at Junior Vasquez Club. And I can never remember if it was Sound Factory or Twilo at the time. It might've been the last night at Sound Factory actually. And I had no idea that the song was already so big in the clubs. Like, I had zero idea. And I remember 6 a.m, my performance, you know, and I'm coming out and this wave of shouts, screams and love, you know, coming towards me, like literally like this wave. And I hadn't even sung a note. The beat started and people went crazy. So that was the first time I realized, oh my God, this is happening big, which without Junior wouldn't have happened, you know? And I'm forever thankful. And so then I would then later go back and then I ended up moving to New York. So then I performed around the United States. And I was always go back to Miami. But at that time, when the song was at its biggest in America, Miami was incredible, you know. I mean, literally just waves of love. And it was as if myself and people had been waiting for that song, you know. Because I remember in one club, I said, well, she'll have been waiting long enough to sing that song. And people just screamed when I said that, you know. And so it was just so beautiful. You know, such a moment.
Yeah, no, I mean, as I said, I mean, that song for me is something very special and something of an era. And I was listening to it this morning again, and it brought up all those wonderful feelings and emotions and warmth. And that's why I think it's so beautiful. Now, I'm going to jump because I want to talk about the album, obviously. And this album was stuck, in a sense, in your drawer for 30 years.
Yes.
And you didn't think about it. You never thought about what that is. You never listened to it in between.
Never.
So when you finally took it out the drawer and listened to it, how did you see the person that had sung and written those songs all those years ago to the person you are today?
Well, it's funny because when we mastered the recordings, because they were very low level on a DAT, you know? And so it took a lot of restoring and trying different approaches to mastering to actually hear everything. And then, so once I could hear everything, I was amazed because actually every word was about what I was going through at that time. And to have had that opportunity at the time, I wasn't even aware of that, you know. Again, something that maybe you don't appreciate when you're that close to it. But, you know, every word, every experience, I mean, it's about my relationship that I was in at the time. And then about some other things too, of course, you know. But yeah, so I was moved. I was moved for the person I was. Because I had never been moved before by that. I just did it, you know, you do it, you move on, you know. And the band breaking up wouldn't have, you know, exactly made anyone go back and listen again, you know. I'm sure that the group, the other guys probably didn't, you know. But now that actually made me feel very moved.
What would your older self have said to your younger self at that time to make you feel better?
I don't know. Oh my God.
Because an album is a snapshot of all these feelings, emotions, and thoughts. So it is very much where you were at that time. And as we change and develop in life, we reach another point, which is often more comfortable with ourselves, let's say, and who we are, and not having the same problems and angst and whatever that we had when we were younger. So, you know, is there something very comforting about knowing not only that, I mean, not only that the music is fantastic and not only what you created there has immense value today, but knowing that you got through a period and got to where you are today.
Well, I think, I'm not sure exactly what I would say, but what strikes me is the realness in the lyrics and the delivery. I was just shouting it out. I mean, the determination with which I'm telling my story. And I think there are two examples. One is the first song, Insatiable Love. She flies into the room just in time for his call and it's time for a change. You know, so that was happening. And I probably did that daily, you know. And, you know, this kind of telling. And then this, she wants to eat the whole world. She tosses and turns like a secret ballet, you know, aching for the thrill of not feeling pain. Wow, I mean, that's heavy shit, you know. And how did I even come up with those words? So I would say something about, well, girl, you certainly kept it real, you know. And then the other song, Deadline for My Memories, where I'm like, there's a body on the floor that looks like me, you know. I mean, that's me crying. That's about me crying for the breakup of the relationship, you know, and thinking, is this me that's going through all this trauma, you know?
Has it changed your memories of those times? Because, you know, like we have times in our life where we feel, oh, I was pretty unhappy back then. But then later on, you look back and you look upon it differently and you don't see it in the same way. And this album is connected to a lot of difficult experiences, not just musically, but also what was happening with your career and everything back then. Has this actually sort of given you a warm feeling of some sort of positive outcome?
Well, it was the beginning of me getting in touch with myself, because the relationship breakup, which went on and on and on, and me acting like some nutcase about it, you know, started the process of who am I? And I bought all these books, all the spiritual and self-help and esoteric stuff, you know, about who am I really, and who's this person that's looking for someone to validate me, you know, and that didn't happen, so what else is there? So I bought all these books and it helped me tremendously. I mean, that was the start of me going, there's something here that I haven't yet done, you know, and that's me. I've never been to me. I've been to paradise. Seriously. So it started the process, which is ongoing today. So without that, I wouldn't have started that, you know.
Without there being
literally nothing left of me, you know, who I thought I was, you know what I mean? That fighting woman, you know, and that hadn't come to fruition in my relationship. And then there was nothing left of me, of the old me, you know, and then I started on what do I do now, you know?
I mean, I think that's amazing, because creativity is also a compensation for our wounds in life. And, and we work through our wounds through creativity. I'm a writer today. And for me, that's so important to do. But at the same time, I've done a shitload of therapy as well. Because therapy is something where I've really realized, I believe, who I am and become much more comfortable with who I am. Yet I can still look back at my wounds, let's call them my childhood wounds or whatever, and be able to take things out of that for my creativity, my writing today. Has it changed the way that you deal with creativity, because you now have a greater awareness of who you are?
Oh God, yeah, I'm really in control now. And I make a lot of mistakes still, because, you know, I produce my own records now. You know, I've got 4 albums on the go, which are all hopefully nearing completion soon. And, you know, and I'm really having to pull my thing together, you know, to make them happen. And because being the producer, which, you know, I'm having to learn as I go, you make mistakes, and I do, you know, but generally the outcome's been immense. I'm so happy with it, and the mistakes I have to try and deal with them, you know. But so I'm really in control though now.
I mean, the reaction to the album has been universally positive.
The Electribe, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, Electribe, yeah. Wow. So absolutely, I mean, phenomenally positive. And it's almost like, you know, this is where the movie script comes. You know, no one would have believed it. Do you know what I mean? That you can dig up an album 30 years ago and it is so, feels so current. Mm. And it, you know, people are so hungry for it. Yeah. And it works so well. Now, there must be an immense satisfaction going on within you that this was all worthwhile. Is that how you feel today?
Yeah, I felt when the press articles started coming in, I was more surprised than anyone. I honestly just expected another, you know, yeah, there's a couple of people who are going to pick up on it, but nothing will really happen. And then it all sort of started going on, and I was elated. I was really, really, really happy, you know, really, really, I mean, just thrilled, really, and surprised. So,
well, it's a brilliant album. I mean, I've been through it a few times over the last few days, and I've really, you know, enjoyed the tracks on the album, and each individual track has they're very strong, you know, there's not a weak track, you know, it's all very strong. Okay. but that really impressed me, that there was so there was so much there, and you hear that and you look back and you think, who was that record company executive?
I know,
to
right?
Say, you know, this is a pile of shit.
Tell me about it. I know it's and we believed it. That's the bad thing about it. We I think deep in our hearts we actually thought, oh God, you know, because we were discussing a couple of the mixes and we were saying, oh, that's not very good yet, you know. So rather than someone saying, yeah, that's fine, it's something we can fix, someone said, you know, get lost. Do you know what I mean? So it really broke us.
I'd love to see his face today.
I don't think he cares. I don't think he would remember any of it. You know what I mean? Because, you know, yeah.
Yeah, no, but that is, I mean, I know revenge is silly, but in a way, there is this little taste of revenge because it's in the air that this mistake, you know, he made such a mistake years ago.
Yeah.
And that mistake has led to something which is really fantastic and perfect for today. Now, you talked about these new albums, and one of them is inspired by French music. I understand Charles Aznavour, Jacques Brel. And was French music always in your life? Because if I remember my, you know, youth, my mum loved these sort of torch singers, and Charles Aznavour was amongst them.
Of course,
them.
You know. I mean, Charles Aznavour was the French Liza Minnelli, you know, and his songwriting, his words, that what he wrote about was so ahead of its time. And he was singing, you know, the song What Makes a Man, you know, so he is a young straight man singing about what it is to be gay and being persecuted by society. That was not done, you know, that was a no-go, you know, and he had hits with it, you know what I mean, hit records, and I mean, all of that is so powerful, and, but generally, I grew up with, the album's inspired by everything French movies, movie soundtracks of the 1970s, especially a composer, François de Roubaix. That's how that all started. I heard his music, and I thought, holy crap, I mean, really, I'm gonna do that. And then it quickly turned into something totally different, but you can hear, you know, that influence. And then it's about some of my favorite films, which are either French or about or set in Paris, and the characters in those films, I mean, I read the film scripts and stuff, you know, and so I always make up stories around what else could have happened, or how did the person in that movie really feel if they're not saying that in the script, you know. So I write songs around those characters, so it's about all that. And then I thought, well, and that would be the opportunity to also sing my favorite Aznavour songs and a couple of Jacques Brel as well.
I mean, my favorite Aznavour song is Yesterday When I Was Young.
I did that one.
Oh my God, I just love that song.
And guess who I played it with? The members of the Tindersticks, the group, the Tindersticks. And because I wanted to make it really weird, like a hypnotic movie soundtrack, you know. And I discovered the Tindersticks film soundtracks and other stuff they've done, and I thought I should just ask those guys. But you don't just go and ask an existing group to come and play. But they came, three of them, and played. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't even believe I'm in the studio with them, you know? And they're very strange. And then two days ago, we recorded a 40-piece string orchestra as well for this. And I couldn't be more thrilled, you know? It's just like, yeah.
And that sounds like it's a really heart project. You know what I mean?
And I mean, yesterday when I was young, he was 25 when he wrote that. It's just crazy what that man did, you know? So
yeah, he was also an amazing film actor.
Yes.
And as well. And I, you know, but yesterday that when I was young, I've always thought, although it's the, you know, the regret and everything.
Yeah.
It's the song that I definitely want at my funeral.
Yeah, right?
Even though I don't regret anything in my life, it's still the song that I want there, because I know everyone's going to be in tears. It's going to really cause havoc.
But how brave it was to sing about these feelings that someone has. You know, he was singing about an old man who regrets, you know, everything that he hasn't done. And he was 25 when he wrote that. Or, you know, when he wrote things like What Makes a Man, about, you know, I'm strip teasing in a gay bar, you know. And this was after, I mean, this man was slaughtered by the French press. He said he couldn't sing, he was ugly, he was short, and he shouldn't be in show business, you know. He was booed off stage. He was, the press hunted him down, you know, and this guy just went, fuck you. And then when he did, I think it was La Boheme, he did that performance, you know, and then suddenly applause came. And then he goes and writes about a gay man when you're not supposed to be gay. I mean, this guy, you know, crazy, amazing.
Yeah, but this, I want to end now, because it's finally that when you talk about, you know, in that way with so much emotion about, you know, another singer and their experience and how they have had to deal with the world, I can see where your power came from and where you've had to deal with your experiences along the way that have been, you know, unbelievably fantastic and unbelievably terrible. You know, they've been extremely hard, and come out of it in such a positive way with such a positive future. So in the end, I just want to thank you for all the creativity you've put out into the world.
Thank you. Some
of the most amazing music, particularly this album. But I still have to say, because it's my favorite and it has such an appeal to me, your Loving Arms was something that so touched me back then. And it was such a wonderful feeling, and because as a gay man and this sort of gay anthem of feeling having these arms around me,
yes,
you know what I mean, and protected.
Don't that make was me cry me now.
The song was about. So,
God, you're gonna
don't
make cry. Me cry.
Don't cry.
Oh my God!
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews, and here is where you can connect.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.